brought to you by GMSDC Radio and broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's time for Let's Talk Small Business with your host, Stacy Key.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and let me first say this is not Stacy Key. Rather, this is Vic Bolton, the victorious one, and I'm sitting in for her today. Ms. Key is engaged otherwise in business. She's an entrepreneur, a business owner, president of an organization, and she's got many, many hats, and today she was unable to be here. So I am substituting for her today on the best small business radio show on the air. We're in the studios of Business Radio X in Midtown Atlanta, and we've got a dynamic guest that we're going to bring forward in just a minute to share some more with us on the topic of IT and cybersecurity. We all know how humbling it can be and how desperate things can become when someone hacks your network or steals your credit card number or gets into your phone and charges stuff on it or whatever. And that's the world that we live in today. So we're talking a lot about what the small business owner can do to be ready for those kinds of attacks and to protect themselves while still doing business in a cloud-based and mobile and Wi-Fi kind of world. So we have with us today Mr. Kevin Mobley, who is the CEO of a firm called the Ian Thomas Group, LLC, here in Atlanta, and he's going to share some things with us in just a minute. I wanted to remind you that we air this show every Tuesday at 11:30 a.m. East Coast time, but you can hear it anywhere in the world. And you can also listen live on the internet at letstalk.businessradiox.com. That's Let's Talk with no punctuation, .businessradiox.com. So tune in weekly for nuggets of information and wisdom and tools that you can use to be successful in your small business. Welcome, Kevin. Thanks for being here today.
Sure. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your company, how it started, and whatever background you choose to share.
Sure. My name is Kevin Mobley. Thanks for having me here today. I started the company in 2008 because I had worked in corporate America since 1992 and had worked for a number of large companies. And in the late 90s, when the internet first took off, I became an expert in this area called software performance engineering, which is, I always tell people, when you think about what happened with healthcare.gov and the site going down and people couldn't get online to register and look for health insurance options, that problem is the one that I've been working on since the 90s for both major corporations, startups, and what have you. I worked at in the late 90s at a company called IXL, which was one of the major players in the internet space. I built their practice and left there in the early 2000s and worked for a couple other major companies. And having done the work a number of times, I wanted to have a deeper impact on our clients. This is the area of software, unfortunately, and this along with cyber are the two areas that tend to get less attention when people are creating software. People get excited about the bells and whistles and functionality you can provide in software, but they don't think about the operational side. What happens when this thing goes live and you've actually got to get it up and stand it up and get it to work and perform and what have you? And so the company was really started to really deal with that problem of making software perform and much more reliable and much more stable.
Now, you said that you named the company for your son. Tell that story.
So when I first started the company, we were all sitting around trying to figure out names. My wife had an idea. She's like, you know, we really should name the company in a way that doesn't sound like it was started up yesterday. And so my son's name became part of that, the Ian Thomas Group. So a lot of people kind of joke with me and say, it sounds like it's an old English company that's been around, you know, for 100 years. I go, yeah, well, that's perfect.
You have a family crest or whatever,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Now, you spoke to software performance engineering, and you said something that piqued my interest. I worked in the IT and in the computing space for a while. And you said that they tend to not engineer the systems to handle the traffic and whatever. The uninformed would think that that was more of a hardware-specific thing, because that's what we were taught 20 years ago, that you didn't have enough memory or there weren't enough channels or points of access into the system. I hear you saying it's more about the design of the actual software.
It is. And actually, it's funny because the speed of hardware is what somewhat caused the problem. And when computing first took off in the 70s, you had physicists and mathematicians writing the code. Computing power is very limited, and so you had very skilled resources. I mean, the brightest, most brilliant minds. As hardware got faster and faster and faster, people began to, and computing began to take off. As it became more and more ubiquitous in our life, you had more and more folks jumping into the arena. The barrier for skill sets began to get lower and lower and lower. And when a company had to decide on priority of resources, getting something out the door became way more important than getting something good out the door. With fast hardware, you know, if you listen to the mantra in the 90s, was hardware could solve all problems, right? You just throw more hardware at it and it scales and you didn't have performance issues. Unfortunately, there were catastrophic problems with software systems that had tons of hardware behind them. I mean, I've worked on systems that had literally millions and millions of dollars of hardware sitting at virtually no utilization, 2 or 3, 4 or 5%, and the system was taking minutes to respond. So then the question is, well, we got all the hardware in the world at this, you know, why is this not performing? It's because the architecture itself is bad. Kind of think of it this way: if you have a bridge and you're driving along in a Ferrari, and you come up on a one lane bridge, and you got a guy there sitting on a donkey with hay, pulling hay. He's moving about 2 miles an hour, and you've got this car that's capable of doing over 200 miles an hour, and you can't go any faster than that 2 miles an hour hay. And that's exactly what happens in the software. When you've got poorly written code, it doesn't really matter how much hardware you throw at it. It's just things are just not going to move that fast.
So your own background is what? Engineer, coder? Where'd you come from?
I got a couple degrees. My first degree is both of them are in system engineering. I got an undergrad degree from George Mason University. I was actually going to design high-end audio. That was my original love. But then I fell in love with this area called human factors, which is all about how do you design computers so that everyday folks can use them. And that passion around human factors got me to my master's degree, which is in system engineering as well, but from Georgia Tech. And the focus there was around human-computer interaction.
Well, it's funny, the human factors area that you mentioned is a part of the problem, frankly, because I know a number of, quote, self-made IT professionals who make a good living doing various work for people. And I'm not saying they're not competent, but when you and I were kids, if you didn't have at least a 4-year engineering and or computer science degree, you couldn't work in the space because you couldn't grasp it. Mm-hmm. And with all of the GUIs and the different things that have come online in the decades since then, about anybody with a keyboard can attempt to get into the space.
Oh yeah.
And so it has changed the dynamic a lot, and it's also changed a lot of the cybersecurity concerns that we have, because there are so many different folks with access to this thing called the internet and who can attempt to get into your world.
Absolutely. Yeah, you've hit on the problem. I mean, so everything I've just said around poor design that leads to slow performance is also the same problems that lead to systems being vulnerable. I had an opportunity back in when I was in the last company I worked at before I started my own. They sent me over to India to evaluate the team that was working for me. And I'm sitting there, and they had a pitch come in, and they had a group come in with some software. It says, hey, you guys who have no background whatsoever in security, have no understanding of how to write code, period, you can use this software and actually go off and run these tests. And these tests are going to somehow tell you if the software is secure or not. And this is running banking software in the U.S. This is not, you know, some average software. And I sat there and I just kind of scratched my head. And I said, there were so many problems wrong with this, I can't even describe. I used to work for, you know, a couple major defense contractors when I first got started. And the engineering discipline there was far greater than what I was looking at here. First of all, the people that were expected to run the test had no security background, had no coding background. Second of all, we're in a country where the ability to know who is who is tough here. And as you start to travel around the globe, you start to see just how easy it is for someone's cousin to slip things in. So I'm sitting here looking at this process and going, it would be so simple for someone to slip in something in the back door of this code that's going to come and run. And if the only check that we're going to look at before this code goes into production at a bank is what these guys are going to do, there are multiple layers of failure already built into this process.
Yeah, points of failure are really critical. We were talking earlier about how the internet is this magic thing that everybody sees as the Wi-Fi signal from upstairs or the Ethernet cable in the wall. And people have no concept of the number of servers and routers and repeaters and power boosting gadgets and so forth. Yep. Between you and the content that you're accessing or the bill that you're paying or the bank that you're talking to. Yep. Talk a bit about some of the points of failure that you see in your business.
Well, from a security standpoint, I mean, every time you go to a Starbucks or any free Wi-Fi, go to a hotel, you're always open and vulnerable. You know, when you just look at what you do in your own home, you know, how you decide to open. A lot of folks, you go up to their house and their Wi-Fi is wide open, or it's broadcasting, or it doesn't have any real light. I mean, maybe using a little simple web key. All those things make it really easy to get on the systems. One of the things that you kind of got to decide is kind of looking at like financial security, financial issues. If you you think of someone stealing your credit card or taking cash from you, you have to basically monitor the activity. What is the loss I'm going to experience? And so you could easily get so paranoid about all the ways in which you're vulnerable, because you're vulnerable across the board. You're vulnerable on your phones. You're vulnerable. So you could either go completely dark and start and become, you know, your personal version of North Korea and not have any connection to the world. Or you can decide that you need to understand your own personal vulnerabilities, your financial vulnerabilities, your personal information vulnerabilities, and be able to monitor those things and understand when those things have been compromised. So if there's money missing from your account, if there's people opening up things suspiciously, then take action on that.
A stray email from someone you know that doesn't sound like them, it asks you something goofy like, hey, look what I found on Facebook. Or, yeah. Bet you didn't see this video.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you don't know the person, and even if you know the person, look at the email before you open it. I mean, look at the actual email, because I get it, because people, folks in my company have somehow gotten themselves on some weird emails, so I somehow get their name, you know, I'll get the, you know, Bob, and I know Bob, I trust Bob, but if I look carefully at Bob's email, I realize it's not Bob's email, it's Bob at, you know, imgonnahackyou.com.
Mm-hmm. So. Or it's got some suffix after the dot that lets you know it's in China or Russia or someplace.
Yep.
You probably don't know anybody.
Exactly.
Well, you know, it's interesting nowadays too. The we talked earlier about the convenience aspect of this thing. We had a guest last week who shared with us how one of the ways you can help yourself is to isolate pieces of your life, to only use a particular computer or gadget for your banking and use a different one for your social media and use another one for email or whatever, mm-hmm. so that if any one area is compromised, it doesn't compromise your entire life. Mm-hmm. Share some of the things that you've seen in your business and some of the steps you've taken to overcome those.
Again, I'm a big proponent of paying close attention, just like you watch your bank account, paying close attention to your actual information. Because you are going to get hacked. You are going to get, there's no way to simply around that. And the idea that you can lock yourself down in a way that you're never going to be compromised is a very false sense of security. Everything in our lives today are becoming greater and greater connected. Our cars, our appliances, you know, and there's absolutely good reasons for wanting those things connected. So, I respect the idea that, you know, I'll do simple things like, okay, I'll use one browser for social media. I'll use a different browser for banking. I'll do simple things like that. I agree with the idea that if you have the luxury of having multiple different devices and you can only use this one for computing or only for work or only for the bank.
But if not, you can somewhat mimic that concept with different browsers.
I do different browsers for some of that control. But I can't overemphasize the idea that check your bank account regularly. You know, pay attention when you start getting weird accounts being opened in your name. If you start getting mail that you didn't expect, you know, if you start seeing things that look suspicious, I mean, don't just ignore it. Like, assume that someone has hacked you. I think that is a much better approach to assume that you're going to have a problem than it is to try to lock yourself down, because you can't build the guard gates. You cannot build them high enough.
And it's challenging in today's environment too, with the number of times and places folks will sign you up for stuff and subscribe you to newsletters and things. Yeah. You send them one email or you're in a group with them on something someone else sent, and they've added everybody in that group to an email from a newsletter that you're not interested in.
Yeah, oh yeah. It happens all the time.
You got to spend some time unsubscribing and scrubbing yourself off of some of that stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, like to the compartmentalization idea, I'll do simple things. Like, I have a lot of email addresses, and they're work email addresses. There's, you know, there's email addresses I use for subscribing to things. There's product emails, travel emails. I've got, you know, a dozen emails. And that's just mainly to try to deal with some of the spam problems. So if I get an email that's important, I want it to go to a certain place.
Okay. Well, let's talk about what happens if you come propose and I don't have the money, or I think you're too expensive or whatever, and I don't hire someone like you to help me. Mm-hmm. What kinds of risks am I taking? What sort of things have you seen out there when the software has not been engineered to fit the application properly?
Sure. So if we're going to talk in cyber, because I'm going to kind of focus on security for a second. Everyone knows that what happened to major brands in terms of lost customer confidence, stock price hits, cash being, you know, that problem is not limited to just if you are a large corporate entity. In fact, some of the most interesting cases around security have happened to very small shops because the barrier to entry is far lower. If it's pretty interesting to see, you know, a Target or someone like that getting hit, and they have staff, they have computing and what have you, imagine what it's like to run a small copy shop. The ability to just to protect yourself is much less, right? So there's ability in a coffee shop or a copy shop or a gas station takes credit cards just like Target does. And they have customer information just like Target does. And most and a lot of businesses these days have loyalty programs. So now you've got people's email addresses, home addresses, lots of personal information. So if you're a small business and you're not at least thinking about how are you protecting your own data, you're putting your business at serious risk. And it's not going to be too long before the ability to sort of to say, hey, not my problem, it's going to become harder and harder from a liability standpoint. Security is undoubtedly the battlefield of the future. When something happened interesting in the first Iraq War, China, with their million man army, took a look at what the United States was doing with smart bombs and said, this is unbelievable. Because you can remember Schwarzkopf and those guys standing in front of the TV talking about showing a bomb going down through someone's chimney and blowing them up, you know, and having that kind of accuracy that no one had ever seen that kind of technology before. So the Chinese looked at it and said, we could throw bodies at this force as much as we want, but it'd be kind of like, you know, going back years and years ago, when one army shows up with guns and the other army shows up with spears, it's an unfair fight. Same thing happens when technology enters the battlefield. So they went back and looked at this, and they wrote a relatively small book, but it was a pretty powerful book about how to actually attack a technology-savvy company, country. And so it goes beyond just how to attack a warship or a fighter pilot, you know, a fighter jet. I mean, those are important. But it goes to things like everyday stuff, like how to take out a power grid, how to take out a water system, how to take out communication, banking, all the things that people depend on. And so when I say it's the battlefield of the future, it truly is. But it goes well beyond, you know, when we think of battle and we think of an army meeting another army. Now it's a battle that's going to go directly into your home, directly into your personal life. And you've seen cases even in the past week where the Chinese have gone in and stolen tons and tons of data out of federal computers, you know, so now they've got they're building a database basically of the United States.
And I think your comment earlier about the false sense of security is really apropos because we all have these things that we take for granted. And it's, there's no telling how fast the anarchy would take over if the power grid was gone, there was no air, the water wasn't flowing, mm-hmm. there was no power in the wall, there was no gas available because there was no electricity to run the pumps at the station, how quickly we would descend into some kind of third world chaos if we didn't have all those things we take for granted.
We experienced it 2 years ago. You remember when they had the snowmageddon that everybody said, you know, and all of a sudden everybody hit the road at the same time and we had, you know, what, 24 hours of gridlock? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one. You're absolutely right. Imagine if every stoplight stopped working. You didn't have the ability to get power anywhere, and it's 100 degrees outside. You know, your refrigerator stops working.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a good look. Yeah, not at all. So, talk about some of the changes that you've seen. You said you started your business how many years ago?
2008.
Okay. And you obviously worked in the industry for a number of years before that. Sure. How are things evolving from what you saw when you started in the business versus the way things are now?
Some interesting phenomena. Computing continues to take a deeper and deeper position in our life, and that's not going to stop at all. It's going to continue to accelerate. There's lots of great reasons why. The business side of computing, though, has grown a lot, and that's been exciting for me because a lot of what I've been talking about around computing is about how poor performance and security impact the business versus, you know, as a geek talking about, hey, here's the problem inside the code itself or here's the problem inside of a server. And when I got into technology in the 90s, you know, the business side sort of assumed that technology was a problem for that group down the basement. And then it eventually elevated to the guy sitting at the end of the table in the boardroom. Today, it's become a problem that everyone who has any position of authority in the organization has to now be a master of. No longer, I've hired a guy or hired a girl to deal with that. Now it's, I've got to be responsible for this. And in no greater area, actually, than security, to be honest with you. If you looked at some of the CEOs losing their job, you've looked at a number of the people who are getting fired because the end of the day, people can't understand how did this happen.
And they're not protecting the company's assets adequately.
No.
And what's your primary job as the CEO is to protect the health, the wealth, the intellectual property, the human resources, all of those things that make up your company.
Absolutely.
So you've been at it for how many years now, 20?
20 years. 1992 is when I started, so 23 years.
So you remember the Atari 64s and the things we had back then that we thought were computing power?
Yeah.
So share a bit about the customer and business impact of shortcomings in the space where you work. You were talking off air about a story that had happened in your business.
Sure. You know, I've seen lots and lots of major failures. I mean, I talk about healthcare.gov like it was this, you know, and it was a very complicated site. I know the folks that are currently working on rebuilding it, and it's a very complicated piece, probably the most complicated piece of software ever tried to be deployed, because it's not one system. It's hundreds and hundreds of systems that are being integrated together. But I've seen those same failures in some major banks. I've seen major banks literally not know what the cash position of the bank is and have literally losing millions and millions of dollars a day. I have
not losing as in stock price depletion, but losing in misplacing.
Misplacing cash. So you're a teller in a bank. You got $250,000 in your drawer. Your drawer all of a sudden disappears from the system. Now you've got $250,000 that's unaccounted for. Needless to say, there were some sticky fingers.
Woohoo, let's go shopping.
Yeah,
right.
You've got, you know, you had situations with customers coming in, couldn't get access to their cash. You had customers that were trying to secure loans for the small business. This was a real case, and a customer, because they couldn't get some paperwork pushed through the system, they were literally not going to get a loan, which was going to cause them to lose a major government contract. So I've seen lots of situations like that. Today, I just happened to be on one of my social media sites, and one of my friends happened to post that he was trying to get on a major airline site to use his airline points, and he couldn't get on it. He was convinced it was a conspiracy that they were purposely crashing the site so he couldn't actually use his points to book his flight. And, you know, it seems like a fairly simplistic problem, but it's actually a pretty major business issue because that customer is going to make a phone call, and that phone call is going to cost $30 or $40 to be handled versus the couple cents it would have cost to book it through that.
Yeah. And the old adage about the happy customer still applies. The happy customer says little or nothing.
Yep.
But the upset customer calls everybody he knows and says, don't ever fly so-and-so airlines. They're horrible.
Absolutely. All day long. All day long.
So in the space where you are, there is a cost associated with not having the bandwidth, the whatever it is that it takes to make a customer-facing program like that fly. Mm-hmm. Talk about those costs a little bit.
So this year alone, I've been doing a lot of work on quantifying poor performance costs. So looking at the actual transaction cost of something and relating it to every incident that happens and what that turns into in terms of dollars. And that's been some pretty eye-awakening work because we've never really quantified slow performance or, you know, when something goes down, you can say, okay, I'm losing this many dollars an hour. But when something just takes a long time and you start seeing abandonment rates, you start seeing retries. I've had a customer, we had some situations where customers, we were working on this banking app that allowed you to scan checks so that you could do it off, you know, you could do it at home. And some of the things that customers were doing was unbelievable. I mean, hours. And for me, I couldn't imagine sitting there for 5, 6, 8 hours trying to scan a check in. I'd have threw the phone out the window. I'd have fired the bank. I mean, I'd have been done with it. But you just saw customers just trying. And you don't know if they were just that persistent or frustrated or what, but just the amount of energy. And believe it or not, there's a real cost associated with it. There's cost of the customer and all the time they're tying them in the system. They were impacting other customers. So there was a real issue there. Around the security piece of it, we've talked a little bit about the financials, but one of the things that I'm starting to see is a real trend is dealing with this idea of advanced threats. And that's an area that we decided to get into because unlike, when I first looked at cyber, lots of people say, hey, you should jump in. And I was looking at what the work were being done. A lot of it was the same work that was being done in the 90s is around penetration testing and what have you. And for me, that wasn't that wasn't going to solve any more problems than doing stress testing and performance testing in my existing world. If I test something and it doesn't work, great, but I've already deployed it and people expecting it to use it. So I need to build it in the right in the first place. So therefore, when I deploy it, it'll work. When it comes to advanced threats, you kind of have the same situation. If you don't know the advanced threats are basically, let me try to explain a little bit to the audience. There are threats that most security systems work with what they call signatures. So once something is discovered, it has a signature. It becomes part of a database that these various virus protection tools use and say, hey, this looks like a signature. So think of it as, some guy walking down the street and you know his profile. You say, oh, yeah, that's the bad guy right there, right? So that's kind of the idea of a signature. There are millions and millions of pieces of malware being released every day. And a lot of them are brand new and they have no signature yet because no one has previously discovered them. And the amount of change might be minor from they might look very similar, almost like a bunch of twins running around. But it's just enough difference that it can fool the software, the protection software. And those are where that's developed those zero-day threats that people often talk about. Mm-hmm. The idea is that this new threat comes out. No one's discovered it no one's discovered it in the past. That threat is where the goal of that threat is to basically extract data from the organization. And so what will happen is there's a period of time before the threat itself can be properly identified, then develop the signature, and then the system can be protected against. And during that time, let's say it's a week, let's say it's a month, let's say it's 6 months. During that time, all the systems are vulnerable to have data stolen from them. So there's a lot of work right now going on around behaviors, which is let's forget about the idea of keeping people out, but let's think about behavior that indicates something is leaving. So that's very similar to what I said about thinking about on a personal level, right? If you gave everybody in the world your password to your bank account, it wouldn't matter as long as someone never took money out of your account, right? So some of the advanced work around behaviors is looking at is when data is leaving the organization, when there's a set of behavior that's indicating data is about to leave the organization, when data is leaving certain very, very high value assets in your organization, and being able to quickly identify those patterns so that, within an organization, you've got, people that have lots of intellectual property on their machines to people who have no intellectual property in their machines, right? The person has no intellectual property in their machine, I could care less if they get hacked all day long, right? I mean, yes, it's an annoyance. Somebody's got to go over there and clean up their machine, but it provides very little business vulnerability for me. But the CEO's machine, the CFO's machine, the person in charge of research and development, the person in charge of client list, whatever, those folks' machine that get hacked, those are very important assets, right? And I want to know that data is leaving those machines, and I want to stop that data from leaving those machines and get those machines cleaned up as quickly as possible. And so it starts this whole process around behavior analysis, automation, because what happened in the case of a lot of these major exploits we've seen is that there were literally thousands and thousands of alerts. So it's like being in a cockpit of an airplane if you've never flown an airplane before. And you got all this stuff that's just beeping and buzzing and lights flashing. What do you do, right? Especially if you got three or four folks working for you. So what you want to be able to have is really, really good data analytics that pull up the most important vulnerabilities to the top of the list and really are ones that are indicating that data is leaving your organization. And that is where you say, okay, that group right there, that's the ones I go focus on. So if I've got, for simplicity, 1,000 vulnerabilities at any moment, but I got three vulnerabilities that would represent 90% of my financial loss. I want to tackle those three vulnerabilities because if I can shut those down, I can protect 90% of my assets. The other 10%, I'm willing to take it as a loss compared to losing my 90%.
But is it not fair to say that in many customer-facing industries, 100% of their business flows through their technology?
Sure.
If you're an airline, there's no such thing as a paper anything like we used to use in the old days.
Yep.
For this, a reservation or a baggage handling, barcoded system, everything they're doing is flowing through the enterprise system, yes?
It's happening in very sophisticated, complex industries like airlines and, you know, banking systems, retail systems. But it's happening in some very previously unsophisticated environments like taxi cabs. So when you start to think about this, the ability to use data to take a previously, you know, low technology system and all of a sudden turn it on its head. That's what Uber became, that's what Airbnb has become in the rental market, not just hotel, but in the rental market business. Previously, people just call people on the phone or whatever, email them. Now you've got this incredibly sophisticated site to go out. So you're absolutely right. The technology has become the modern day manufacturing floor for most businesses. So even whether you produce a hard good or you just produce a service, the technology is really your conveyor belts of today, of yesterday. It's your, you know, it's the warehouse of yesterday. It's where all the real activity goes. And so when that warehouse burns down, that warehouse gets compromised, you're out of business. And so when your technology is not performing, you're out of business. I was over in Africa about 5-6 years ago trying to work with a bank over there. And it was one of the most frustrating experiences I've ever seen in my life, because these guys were trying to do some really good work with enabling technology to bring about 22 countries together so they could all share information and do banking, right, across a very large continent. And the technology they had just wouldn't allow it. So they were limited to just being able to do business within a couple countries and not even between countries. And so and the types of problems they were running into, we don't even fathom. Like, literal communication issues. You know, they would make jokes that however we can get the data from point A to point B, it could start on a satellite, it could come down a plain old telephone line, it could go across Wi-Fi, you know, it could damn near be a carrier pigeon that brings it over. I mean, it was like however we can get the data from point A to point B. But when you think about building software that's able to operate in that kind of complex environment, most of the software that we build are built for a U.S. environment or for a European environment where the infrastructure, people assume certain speeds. And so these guys just didn't have it. So they literally could not do, from a business standpoint, what they were trying to do because the technology wouldn't allow it.
We are running out of time, and this is fascinating. So believe it or not, I have an engineering degree I'm wasting. So most people don't know that's what I studied in school. So you start talking about gadgets, toys, and technology, and I'm there. But we've got to get off the air here in just a second. Give us a quick, if you were to talk to our small business audience out there listening, what would be the one thing that you would share as the high priority, must-do thing for the small business owner who has a concern about cybersecurity?
Take it seriously. Assume that you've already been compromised and you're actively compromised at the moment, and focus extensively on your data and your assets. And how do you keep the data and the assets from leaving your organization?
And share your website address with us, so if any of our folks want to reach out to you, they can.
Yes, www.ianthomasgroup.com.
Well, listen, Kevin, thank you again for being here. We'll have to have you back so we can finish this conversation. There's a lot more to talk about in this space, and half an hour doesn't do it justice, but thank you so much for the time.
Sure.
Thank you. All right, folks, that's it for us today. Thank you so much. Remember, as small business goes, so goes America. Tune in next week for Let's Talk Small Business.